I really am so glad to talk with you and your audience. Thanks a lot.
We want to smash, crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Eleanor Goldfield, co-hosting with Mickey Huff. For this episode, I've also been your associate producer, and Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Project Censored Radio airs on roughly 50 stations across the U.S., from Maui to New York. And you can find all our previous archived programs by going to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram just before we get deplatformed. And be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your digital tethering devices podcast application. Please feel free to contact us, share your feedback, or learn more about our work at projectcensored.org, and see our new publishing imprint, The Censored Press, at censoredpress.org. To learn more about my work or to contact me specifically, please visit my website at artkillingapathy.com. You can also follow me on social media at Radical Eleanor. Last but not least, thank you so much to our listeners for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. Fiend at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
On the next Voices for the Animals, we'll be speaking with Howard Garrett of the Orca Network about the plans to release Lolita, also known as Tokate, an orca who has lived in captivity performing for over 50 years.
The same people who are trying to splash cold water on the whole idea and discourage any talk of Toki coming home, they paint this picture of her as being, you know, really decrepit and couldn't possibly survive the journey, and that's just not true at all.
We'll also talk with Courtney Scott of In Defense of Animals about why our own Oregon Zoo has landed on their list of 10 worst zoos for elephants for the 12th year in a row.
Elephants are uniquely unsuited to captivity, and just by their size alone, they require miles to roam, and without that base, they literally suffer brain damage.
Don't make any summer plans that involve seeing animals in captivity until you listen to the next Voices for the Animals show, airing Friday, June 23rd at 10 a.m. here on 90.7 KBOO FM.
I don't believe that we can achieve anything resembling human fulfillment within the structures of capitalism.
For the Wild is honored to present The Edges in the Middle, a series of conversations between Bio Komolafe and thought companions like John A. Powell, V, Naomi Klein, and more. These limited episodes have been adapted from Bio's work as the Global Senior Fellow at UC Berkeley's Othering and Belonging Institute. In this role, Bio has been holding a series of public conversations on issues of justice and belonging for the Institute's Democracy and Belonging Forum, which connects and resources civic leaders in Europe and the US who are committed to bridging across differences to strengthen democracy and advance belonging in both regions and around the world. Bio's conversations encourage us to rethink justice, hope, and belonging by sitting amidst the noise, not trying to cover it up with pleasant rhythms. To learn more about the Democracy and Belonging Forum, visit democracyandbelongingforum.org. This recording features Bio's conversation with scholar, author, and activist Kianga Yamata Taylor. Kienga is a professor in the Department of African American Studies at Northwestern University and a 2021 MacArthur Foundation Fellow. She is a thought leader on Black politics, social movements, and racial inequality in the United States. Informed by Bayo Komolafe's essay, Black Lives Matter, But to Whom?, Kienga and Bayo explore a set of questions stemming from the provocation, What if justice gets in the way?
I want to say a few things again, as I'm now traditionally known to, about what this is. This is an experiment in conversation. This is an experiment in the Mbari, which is the Igbo. The Igbo people are from Eastern Nigeria. They're a noble people, powerful people, beautiful stories, and wonderful cosmologies. Part of that cosmology is this art form, which we have tried to articulate these conversations around. The idea of the Mbari isn't to arrive summarily at a notion of truth. We're not looking for truth here. As important as that designation is, we're not looking for a way to arrive at consensus or agreement, as useful as those are strategically as well. The idea here is to listen with each other, to listen diffractively, to create art with words and textures and memory and feeling that allows us to see each other, including you listening, as gestures, minor gestures, instead of stabilized points in space-time. So we are not atomic entities trying to finalize our positions. We are touching each other, so to speak, and creating art with our conversation that we allow to be composted by the earth. Nothing that is said here needs to be grasped as some final principle or fundamental reality. We give it back to the earth, just as the Igbos with the Mbari process would give their art forms back to the earth to be eaten by the goddess Allah. So it's with that I welcome you to this conversation that is premised and derives from an essay that I wrote a couple of months ago, not too long ago, January. I think it was published in February by my people here at the Institute. And the premise of this conversation is, what if justice gets in the way? Now, that doesn't sound right. Justice feels like the thing to arrive at. It's what we all want. To say justice gets in the way, or to suggest that it might get in the way, is to trouble the relationalities, the way we relate with the public, especially how Black bodies are situated within modern civilization. It is to cast our gaze beyond our fight for inclusion and to kind of bring in a historicity, a history, a narrative, a storytelling tradition that stretches beyond the moments of capture and captivity and beyond that, not just into the past, but into the future, into a speculative future, to ask questions about what we are doing and what is being done to us in our quests for justice, right? So I don't know that there is any other person that I would like to have this conversation with except Kianga, Professor Kianga Taylor. I have followed and admired her voice in the United States for some time. And when the prospects of this came up, I jumped at it, not only because of the soul and the rigor with which she speaks to these matters of justice, but because of, let me call it, a weather of wisdom that surrounds her. So it is my great pleasure to bring Kianga into this virtual space. Welcome, sister.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very much looking forward to the conversation.
And you're joining us from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
The seat of democracy.
The birthplace of American democracy.
The birthplace of
whatever on earth that is worth.
And what feels very, very urgent and very, very potent right now to say as we dive into this is, how do you feel about that question? How did it land with you? The problematic, troubling idea that justice might get in the way. And then we move wherever we want to go. This is emergent.
Sure. Well, thank you again for the invitation. And, you know, thank you for the provocation that is your essay. there are a few immediate things that come to mind for me. One of which is the question of, some of this is specific to the essay, which is the audience in terms of who it is that you're writing to, because in some ways, you know, I think that the participation in Black Lives Matter and its many different iterations is quite varied. And, you know, people come to this desire for movement from different positions, with different thoughts, with different politics. So that's one thing. Mm-hmm. I think when, you know, about the question of justice, does justice get in the way? Is justice limiting? I think yes and no. Yes, in the sense that, you know, if we only conceive of justice in the existing political paradigm, if we only conceive of it in the ways, the narrow and confined ways that in an American context, an American ruling class conceives of that, then of course justice is incredibly limited. And we saw that throughout the different kinds of responses of Black Lives Matter. So we could talk about the first wave of protest with Black Lives Matter in 2014 and 2015, where the main kind of sense of reform and forms of justice had to do with police commissions and, you know, making sure that the police had body cameras.
Right.
The second wave of protests, you know, produced this George Floyd Policing Act, which was, you know, kind of toothless and, different things that basically keep the system of policing intact. Mm-hmm. So there's that. There's a kind of normative sense of justice and reform that, you know, is attractive to some people. I think that there's also, when I say no, there's also, I think, a more capacious sense of justice that comes from people engaged in the movement itself, and it comes from people who are oppressed. And so I think that in that sense, justice is not just about tools meant to restrain the police or restrain the violent impulses of the state. Justice is about what do we have to do to live more meaningful lives. And so that, I think, is important, which is to say that these concepts are not stable and static, delivered to us from on high or delivered to us in the forms that they emerge from through the Enlightenment. You know, that the struggles of oppressed people have also changed their meaning, or at least put the meaning of seemingly stable categories into conflict and contestation.
Yeah.
And so the one thing that I had questions about in the essay is, are you holding these concepts to be too stable, to see them only as a manifestation of the desires of the West, only as a manifestation. So we think about justice or freedom only as they are conceived of by those who put them into the universe at a particular point in time and had a very specific meaning for them. In the United States, the colonial leaders understood freedom in a particular way because they all held slaves. Mm-hmm. And they knew what the absence of freedom looked like. And so their conception of freedom was organized in response to slavery. But of course, enslaved people had a very different sense of what freedom was. And so that is just to say that I think that these concepts, which on the surface seem to be reflections of the dominant class and what it is that they desire, are contested and fought over and have come to assume different meaning from the oppressed themselves. And I think that we have to integrate that complexity into the discussion about what seems like stable categories to begin with.
I totally resonate with that. There is a move that is threaded through the essay. And for those who are listening, as my brother a while ago said, this essay is called Black Lives Matter, But to Whom? And it was published in February. And it's available on the internet if you take a look at it. It's a long read. And I'm grateful that Kianga went through it. But there's a move that is privileged in that essay, and that is to stabilize strategically, if only for a moment, accepting that justice and these concepts are contested and contestable, right? But to stabilize it just for a moment of thought to see what other moves are mobilized. And why that is, you know, you asked me just before we came on what precipitated, what led to this, what gave birth to this. It's that following George Floyd, the event of George Floyd, we had a moment of our own. By we, I mean the biggest country in Africa, biggest black nation on earth, right? We had end SARS, that is, end police brutality, SARS representing this violent force that calls into question our wanting to see more brothers and sisters in places of power, right? It queers that a little. And in the struggle to end police brutality, many questions were formulated. Many ideas that have been gestating for a while found expression. Just like the pandemic gave birth to new ideas about schooling and the workplace and organizational arrangements, this gave birth to questions around justice and what justice is doing. We started to have questions or have conversations about how justice is kneeling on our necks, literally, you know, taking the figure of that police officer kneeling on George Floyd's neck. And this has, you know, of course, what I try to do is to trace those beautiful connections that have always existed between diasporic African communities and members of the African continent, right? Blacknesses meeting, Kwame Nkrumah, Martin Luther King, beautiful convergences. I feel there's a new conversation that is troubled or invited in. And I think these conversations are especially needed now in a time when it seems, at least from one perspective, that justice is imbricated with the continuity of modernity. So there is a sense, of course, like you beautifully notice, that we can see justice as this enlightenment thing, right? It's never some transcendent notion. It is emergent from relationship, right? It's how we relate, it's negotiated. But there's also a sense in which it transcends or exceeds those troubling containments. And we can start to see justice. We can even practice seeing justice as something to reach out for. But for now, through the agency of this essay, I wanted to ask questions about how bodies were imported into the human, into the anthropos, right? How Sylvia Winter speaks about the man and what the man is doing and what we're missing if we negotiate the public order in a particular way. So the question for me is, what are we missing? That is the hidden codicil of asking those questions about justice. What are we missing when we, you know, to use Fred Moten's voice, speak truth to power? What is left out when we do that? And where does fugitivity come in? How do we think about the figure of the fugitive through this conversation about what justice occludes, right?
I mean, I guess for me, the problem that I have, because I think that those are legitimate questions to raise. I think they get raised in a different kind of context here. And so this is what I brought up initially about the audience. What I'm speaking to there, and you hinted some of this, I think, well, for certain in the essay, particularly actually when you're talking about the African context, not so much in the US, but certainly in the African context, which is the question of class, the question of different interests. And so part of the difficulty I had with the essay, and just in terms of understanding the nature of the debate and who is being argued with, is that in the US, the movement itself is deeply fractured around questions of class, right? And class influences then questions of strategy and tactics. And so what you were speaking to absolutely applies to and is the concern of a section of this thing that we call a Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah.
And there's also abolitionists within the movement. There are socialists in the movement and people who reject the kind of normative parameters based on what is pragmatic and what is politically possible in our current context. You know, those people populate the movement as well. And so part of the problem has been a kind of lack of engagement, a lack of debate and tension, really, around these sorts of questions within the movement itself. They have been muted and papered over. And so that the kind of liberal voices, those who are most concerned with a kind of what I'm going to describe as a normative sense of justice, normative reforms, those voices have been allowed to dominate and really capture and overwhelm the discussion about what for others is a question of Black liberation and questions that involved, you know, quote unquote, how we might get free. And freedom based on the lack of coercion in making decisions about one's life. Like, what does it mean to achieve actual self-determination? And so, you know, these questions of class and class conflict among Black people in the United States in particular are quite profound, and they have resulted in a very bifurcated notion of what it is that we are fighting for. Because there are people who are totally fine with leaving the hull of the slave ship and just being on deck, you know, and letting the wind blow through their hair, and they're okay with that. And then there are other people who want to not just leave the slave ship, but set it on fire. So the problem is this is all still happening within this concept of community, this concept of a kind of shared Blackness, you know, shared experience. And so that's part of what complicates my kind of thinking about the essay and answering some of the questions that you pose, because to me, those are questions that really engulf a kind of liberal mindset that exists absolutely, but are not shared throughout. You know, so some of the folks, you know, what I might describe as the left of what we are calling the Black Lives Matter movement.
Right.
You know, I don't think, you know, people who see themselves as abolitionists, these are the kinds of ideas and debates that animate those politics.
Yeah.
It's really about how do we look beyond the existing paradigms?
Yes.
How do we imagine different ways of being?
Yes.
Different ways of living. And these come into extreme conflict with other Black people, you know, who see problems with the status quo, but really the problems are about how they fit into it, not the status quo itself.
Inclusion.
That is what you're addressing about the limits of inclusion. You know, of course, I wrote a book about this question as a kind of critique of post-war racial liberalism, and the idea that our sole objective in life is to reject exclusion and simply be included without ever taking stock fully of what it is that we are being asked to be included into.
You said something about coercion and articulated that with regards to freedom, right? How would you, I'm going to use a word that I'm guessing, or I'm hoping that everyone might be familiar with, ontologies, right? The nature of, you know, the reality of. How would you think of freedom then? Freedom being this very, it's a gleaming data point in the intergenerational transcontinental conversation about Blackness, right? We talk about freedom all the time. Martin Luther King talked about freedom, activism is about freedom, but a thread, if you think about it as a biological or symbiotic thread that runs through some of my engagements through the essay and beyond the essay, is the nature of freedom. Do you want to struggle with that? Let's struggle with that a little, sister.
Yeah, I mean, for one, freedom is deeply contested. what we mean by freedom. So, you know, none of these are, as we said earlier, stable, situated, categories, and their meaning and inference and importance, frankly, change over time, right?
And so, maybe I can put it this way, sister: how do you think we are enacting freedom and performing it, and how do you think it's performing us within an architecture of socio materiality of relationships? How are we enacting it, even in demanding certain things of the system that externalizes and oppresses us?
Well, let me just say when I think of the idea of freedom, because I get asked this a lot, like, what does freedom, you know, mean to you? What would liberation look like? And so I mentioned earlier this idea of self-determination, and what does it mean to make choices and decisions in one's life that are without coercion, and that you are thinking or motivated simply by one's desire to move from one place to another, from one thing to another, from one thought to another. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that gets somewhere in the realm of what freedom is. You know, I think that it's not wholly clear to me what it means or how it is ingested in our contemporary society. Mm-hmm. Is it the ability to vote? Mm-hmm. Is it to be free? It's often negative, right? It's like, to be free from harassment, discrimination, these sorts of things, which to me doesn't sound very free at all.
There you go.
And so, you know, I think that, of course, we have a political agenda that is limited by what people think is possible, by what people's expectations out of life have been ground down to, so that I think that it has been reduced to its most basic negative form, mm-hmm. Which is to kind of be left alone, which again is not very free. And so a question that I had for you was really what are you thinking about freedom as something that we should not strive for, right? So what to you, what does it mean to be free? And what would it mean to not have that as an objective, as the center of a political struggle?
I think that, and I'm deriving or I'm sitting with a response that is grounded in these African stories and the ways that elders in my lands have, you know, alchemized the stories of capture and captivity and, you know, and stayed with the trouble, you know, of freedom, right? So running through what I'm sure you recognize as a Yoruba cosmology, with its talk about orishas, is the idea of the pre-individual, which is, if you're listening, you might recognize this as resonating with what a philosopher called Gilbert Simondon articulated. That is, we are not individuals as such that have the property of freedom, right? We are indebted to ecologies, right? We are not isolated. Modernity would have us see ourselves as autonomous, separate beings, right? Who have designation of free or not free. But there is a sense in which even the lack of coercion could be a bind, right? That even without the outward signs of being shackled, we are still tethered to systems and ways of being and ways of seeing. I just had a dear sister, Dr. Erin Manning, say to me or speak to me about the violence of sight, right? That even neurotypicality is normopathic and could execute some kind of capture. So holding these ideas of the notion of flow that breaks down the distinctions between me and my environment, it calls the whole project of freedom into question. It troubles it. Freedom from what is not as powerful any longer as what is using us, what is instrumentalizing us, even without the outward signs of being coerced. How are we part and parcel of algorithms, systems, and ways of thinking that are sticky to get out of? How are we caught up in a death spiral, right? So I don't know what lies beyond freedom. I'm thinking right now of the way that I started out the essay, you know, the crafts running away from the plantation. What I should have added, or what I now think I would want to add if I get to modify the essay, is how, you know, historically, they still had trouble when they escaped. The question is, escaping to what, right? It's always the question of fugitivity. What are we escaping into? Because white modernity, the plantation wasn't as big as what the plantation was serving. The real estate of white modernity was beyond the plantation. So my question is still, what are we running into? How are we co-creating and co-performing freedom? If freedom is still imbricated within specific ways of being that are increasingly problematic, especially now that we know how to name the Anthropocene. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what freedom leads to. All I know how to do is gesture towards something else, exquisite, beyond my language and capacity, that I would signal with the idea of shape-shifting, the crafts turning into birds, Octavia Butler speaking about bodies melting into other bodies. I'm not exactly sure how to think beyond freedom because I'm part of this project as well. Right. But I feel that we're at a turn, sister. We're at a point in our shared histories, colonized and colonizer, right, where the ship is in trouble. And now we have to ask new questions.
I think, yes, I think that we do have to ask new questions. I also think that, you know, I don't believe that we can create or conceive of a different kind of world from the one that we are currently situated in.
I agree, yes.
But I do believe that through the struggles of regular people, ordinary people, that those people have the capacity to create a different context and a different kind of social relation. And so, you know, I'm an anti-capitalist, I'm a socialist, and I believe that capitalism imposes certain material, social, political, spiritual constraints on individuals, socially, society, you know, the whole thing. And I believe that, you know, it also is a system that promotes this kind of self-interest and self individualism. And so someone has asked about self-determination. Is that in conflict with collectivity? You know, I don't think so. I'm not talking about self-determination as individual, you know, individualism. I'm talking about the self as a collective body. Like, what is in the interest of the collective. And it is the collective that determines what is in its interest. And those interests are constantly in flux and changing. But I believe through, and this is where maybe there, you know, I'm a materialist, you know? There's tension in like even how to talk about some of these things. But I believe that people have the capacity to collectively determine in a given moment and circumstance what it is that they need. And I believe that without the particular constraints and obstacles created by capitalism or by, you know, systems that, you know, there's the kind of bureaucratic collectivist states that call themselves socialists, that work socialist. If we think of socialism as sharing of abundance, you know, these are states that, you know, still had the kind of dynamic towards extraction, where the state was in control and ownership, but who owned the state? There was not democratic control of the means by which people govern themselves. There were not democratic control of the state itself. And so, you know, I think that it's through that process of collective struggle that people's ideas about what freedom is, what it means to them in their particular context, changes. I don't know. I think this is, you know, this is kind of where I'm at with this question, because one of the things that occurred to me in the essay was, what is the mechanism? And so for me, the mechanism for the kind of social transformation that I'm talking about is mass struggle. And that mass struggle can't be in and of itself. It can't be struggle for just the sake of struggle. I believe that we have to change the ways, the relations between each other, change the relations between people and how things are produced. I don't believe that we can achieve anything resembling human fulfillment within the structures of capitalism. And so what is the mechanism for this kind of social transformation? It is the self-activity of human beings through collective struggle. And so one of the questions that I had for you was this question of mechanism. How do we go from what we are in today to, as you say, walking away from the constraints of these objectives and concepts into something else, you know, that is not bound by these old ideas? What is the mechanism that propels that process?
It's how people are peopled that is that is really, really energetically powerful for me right now. So let's read insights into each other's in each other, sister. There, when you said I'm a materialist, I know that it's it's I'm a materialist too. It's like of course I would often describe myself as a neo-materialist, along the lines of a post-humanism, of an animism that refuses to center human beings as independent actors, right? So that when we speak about people, I hear processes, right? And I hear fungi, and I hear architecture, and I hear texture, and I hear algorithms that are streaming through the air, so that there's a lot of porosity between the environment and people. So the question is, when you say, for instance, that it's people struggling, collective struggle, that is the mechanism for breakthroughs, I can sit with that, and I know that this is true at multiple levels in our history, in our collective histories. We wouldn't have achieved what we achieve in terms of even living to have electricity in Nigeria, for instance, without people hitting the streets. People are on the streets right now struggling against the tide of, I don't even need to mention it here, you know what's happening probably, a horrible electoral process. But the question for me still remains how people are peopled, that it's not simply about people struggling. It has never been about people struggling, because environments create people, and not in a deterministic final way, but even the ways that we come to struggle, even the ways we ask questions, the imaginations we have about what it means to be free and all of that, is already a mark of a crossroads. There's multiple effects right there. So that it's never about just this monolithic entity struggling for a new dimension. It's how bodies interact with other bodies. So, and I wish I could put my finger on beautiful and resonant examples that suggest that even with struggle, even as important as struggle is, one wants to hold the tension of where struggle has only bequeathed us with the inheritance of repetition, that our struggle has sometimes led to the proliferation of the familiar, right? I will never forget, you know, listening to Bernie Sanders saying that since the 70s, we've been struggling for a response to climate chaos. And he would say, we have to respond to this yesterday, in ways that he speaks. We have to respond to this yesterday. That he would ask the question, why do we keep doing the same things over and over again? I think it's a question that haunts the idea that struggle is the sole or exclusive, which I don't think is what you're saying, but I want to hold that thread of thought, that struggle as the sole or exclusive mechanism for breakthroughs doesn't feel adequate in a post-humanist world where people are peopled in different ways by their environments. So for me, I think about the mechanism of shifts as lingering in the breaks, right? And by the break, I mean to speak about places where, places of deep errancy, right? I can situate errancy in terms of autism. I do this all the time, having been a father of an autistic child. I feel that we have learned to pathologize spaces where novelty thrives, right? And you could see this pathologization in terms of how we treat disabled people, how we treat minorities and all of that, and autistic children. I think that they kind of embody, and I don't want to binarize it like the neurotypicals and the autistics, but there is a dense site of monstrosity. The monster to me is the cultural symbol of strain away from the normal path. There is the monster, and I feel inquiry, a politics that sits with tracing and understanding how we are imbricated with specific social analytics, might allow us to do something different or see something different. Let me put it this way, sister. Now, one problem for me is that we're part of a sensorial monoculture, that even protest and struggle could coexist side by side within a sensory monoculture that engulfs even those that we think are against us, right? We could be part imbricated with the very same systems. I remember seeing a brother telling me that he wanted to get people away from Facebook. And so his method of choice was to use Facebook to get people away from Facebook. It was entirely lost to him, the irony of getting people to do permaculture and away from Facebook by starting Facebook groups, right? It's just a comical example of the ways we're imbricated within systems, yes. Even our struggles are articulated within them. So speculatively, I think of the sight of the zombie being this this monster, but which is a decolonial entity, of course, mm-hmm. With history in Haiti and Black culture. I think of those sites as places of deep interest to me, that it's not enough for us to struggle, because struggle can curdify or reinforce the very conditions, under certain conditions, that we're fighting against, but that we need a way of decentering the struggler. Question for me again is, who is struggling? What is struggling? Is there a stable identity behind the struggle? And if there isn't, if even the struggler is contested and the struggle is contested, then what kinds of spaces can we co-enact that allows us to see differently? This is what I theorize as the monster. Mm-hmm. Stop here for now.
Agree that this is not struggle for struggle's sake, or that the quote unquote or hashtag struggle in and of itself changes everything. Mm-hmm. For me, the possibility of a certain kind of struggle is a mechanism. And the reason why I see it as a mechanism is because struggle from below is disruptive. It breaks the status quo. And it's within those moments of disruption and breaks within the status quo that the other part of this becomes viable. And so the other part of this for me is then politics. Mm-hmm. So there is the symbiosis with objective and subjective factors that create the space for different ways of thinking. And, you know, I have a million different examples of that. So it's not just that you struggle. It's also about the ideas that imbue those struggles. And those ideas are constantly being fought over. I mean, this is the history of the Black struggle in the 1960s. But it was the movement itself that opened up the possibility mm-hmm. of thinking differently about the position of Black people in the United States mm-hmm. without any kind of social disruption, which mm-hmm. the movement represented. Mm-hmm. It was very difficult on a mass level to bring in these ideas about Black freedom, about right. Black liberation, about how Black people could live differently, not to an external audience, but to Black people themselves. And so for me, without the disruption of struggle, because it's true, fascists have mass marches, you know, January 6th in the United States, was a protest, was a demonstration. So it's not just the ability to demonstrate. It's not just the ability to amass people in a certain location. Mm-hmm. I distinguish that struggles in the service of maintaining the status quo, and struggles that are disruptive to it. Those who are in stewards of the status quo may think that a particular movement can help it, is in service to it. But I believe that the longer that a struggle, protest, demonstration, movement of some sort exists, that raises questions about the stability of that society. Now, whether or not there is a particular kind of politics that enter into those gaps, that enter into those fissures, that raise new ideas and different ideas about what society is, what it could be, what its problems are, how to deal with those problems, how to respond to those problems, that's a political question. And that is a question that has to be debated and argued over, and that is not in and of itself a product of street demonstrations, but is a product of political struggle between individuals, between people who are in some kind of dialogue about how do we change things. So that's what I see, those two things working in tandem with each other.
Oh, beautiful. There is a sense, sister, here that I'm in touch with the violence of clock time. This really shouldn't, I really wish we had 2 hours to do this. I do have something to say about about what you, so there, it really needs to be said that, at least I want to say that I agree with the need for struggle. There is no dismissing that. There's no sidestepping like, oh, there's a new political movement afoot, let's get rid of it. No, there isn't any of that. But there is, you know, reality is never pure or categorical. It's promiscuous and unwieldy. There is also, the sense in which the ground beneath our feet, especially in Africa, is widening, you know, probably, you know, figuratively embodied by the crack that is literally dividing Africa into two, running through Kenya at this moment, right? That the ground beneath our feet is going, and that we're finding more and more this to be the case, that our struggle is eaten up, right? That there is some kind of a presumption of able-bodiedness, you know, even in the call, the clarion call to struggle, to fight the powers that be, right? Right. So I'm asking, what do we say to my son who will not look you straight in the eye because visuality is not the premise of his experience, right? He looks to the side, right? He does not gentrify bodies, you know, visually. He looks to the side. Right? What do we say to my son? What do we say to those people in Africa? Are we going to say the same thing, like, just keep struggling? Or is there something else that is possible? And this is not just a question for you, it's rhetorical. That is there something else that can be done within those cracks? Are those cracks now political agents of the in their own rights, inviting new cartographical projects, inviting new directions, without dismissing the need to engage the familiar?
And I would say that we shouldn't reify struggle as a single thing.
Right. That is
not 20-year-olds on the street shaking their fist and, you know, running at cops.
Of course.
It is the ability to say no, either verbally, through what we do with our bodies, a refusal to participate.
Refusal.
In one way or another. And so I, you know, the last thing I will say is that I agree that we absolutely run the risk of reflecting the forces that we are fighting against. I think that we see that profoundly in the U.S., where the right wing is canceling books and banning books. And there is an impulse from parts of the left that when you step out of line, you have a political thought or say something that people disagree with, there is a very intense reaction aimed at disciplining you into not saying it. And so these are mirrored patterns of each other. And I don't believe there's any way out of that without political struggle, which is not about the street. It's about how we engage with each other in what Olofemi Taiwo talks about in the room, in the space. And that is a problem that we have in the United States left, an ability to engage one another in the space, on the plane of ideas, to think differently, and to come together to understand, to create a politics with those outside of the room that can really focus on what it means to be free.
Thank you for listening to this special episode of The Edges in the Middle. The music you heard today was by Sitka Sun, graciously provided by the Long Road Society record label. For the Wild is created by Ayana Young, Erica Ekram, Francesca Glassbell, and Julia Jackson.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
The following program